Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's face-off. On Monday's episode, we experienced a kind of magic with 2018's Bohemian Rhapsody. But now, the show must go on. And today, we meet our challenger. Step forward, Reginald Kenneth Dwight. Yes, hoping to emerge victorious in this week's clash, it's Elton John. Saturday night's all right for fighting, but it's a Thursday, so we're going to use our words to settle this musical battle royale as we welcome our challenger, taking on Bohemian Rhapsody from 2019, it's Rocketman. So, which movie will be able to scream, "We are the champions," by the end of this show? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
The Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
How are you both? You good? Looking forward to chatting?
Yeah.
Looking forward to getting your chat on?
Yeah.
Well, you sound excited, Victoria. Christopher?
Yes. Let's get on with it.
All right. Jeez, no time for pleasantries. Right, so it is this week's round two, Bohemian Rhapsody versus Rocketman. Chris picked these movies. Chris, remind us of the connection.
I called it Battle of the Biopics, though obviously at the start of last episode, we talked about quite a lot of similarities from the director to the subject matter. But before we get into them, I want to ask you two a question about these two films, just a general one. So both these artists sold hundreds of millions of records. But Elton outsold Queen by quite a bit. So why do you think the Queen film outgrossed Elton by so much?
That is a good question.
Honest answer?
Mm-hmm.
I think A, because Freddie Mercury is a more enigmatic character, perhaps, than Elton John. And B, and I this sounds kind of weird and dark, but it's because Freddie Mercury's dead. I think there is something about dying young and becoming a legend than sort of, you know, growing old in the public eye that people are desperate to know about them. And sort of there's an interest there because they're no longer with us, I think, perhaps.
I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good answer, Alex. I will accept that answer.
Thank you very much. I always get tense when you say, "I have a question." So I'm pleased I appeased you.
Yeah, no, it was really, when I was researching this and looking down the list, Elton's the fourth most successful artist of all time. And then just below the top eight, which sold over 250 million, then you've got Queen, who aren't far behind. But I just thought it was interesting that the Queen movie so dwarfed. I think the ratings also got something to do with it. It was a 15. It had more adult stuff in it, whereas Bohemian Rhapsody was, I guess, more of a family film. And I know this sounds stupid, but I did wonder if that John Lewis ad with Elton John did steal some of Rocket Man's thunder. It was a very good ad. It was quite moving, showing him as a kid playing the piano. It was quite similar to some of this film.
Yeah.
I wondered if that had an effect.
What, like if people have seen the advert, they're not going to go and see the film? Is
been,
that what
there, you been there, done that.
Yeah. Oh, I know about him. No.
I mean, to come at it from a personal angle, and I know I spent a lot of Monday's episode going on and on about how much I love Queen, but I don't know whether it applies to everyone, and I'm sure there are a huge Elton John fans in the world, but for me, I think Queen's songs, like, I know Queen's work better. In fact, what am I saying? This is a very personal way of looking at it. I just know Queen's music a lot better, to the point that, like, I walked into Rocket Man the first time I saw it, and I didn't know like what songs were Elton John's. And I will say, I came out of the screening of Rocket Man and I downloaded, I went straight on iTunes for the Tube Journey Home and downloaded loads of Elton John, because like this movie made me love his songs, like that I didn't know were his. Like, I didn't even know that bit in Almost Famous where they sing Tiny Dancer on the coach. I was like, that's a great song from Almost Famous that was written for the movie Almost Famous.
Oh, Alex, that's depressing, Alex.
That's how little I knew about Elton John's music. Sorry I've depressed you, Chris, but yeah, that's the truth. Right then, Chris, you gave Victoria this movie, didn't you?
Yep.
Yep, here we go. Are you ready? Rocket Man is a musical fantasy from the world's most despondent glitter demon, a.k.a. Elton John, as he unreliably narrates his journey from suburbia to stardom to support group therapy, taking in truly awful parents, Richard Madden in a little dressing gown, a Woolworths pick and mix of drugs and booze, except it's not Woolworths because they never sold cocaine, and even if they had, it wouldn't have been the sort to give you a heart attack, which is what Elton John finally has, before sorting himself out, making amends, and learning to hug the child within, leading to our happy ending, where he's 28 years clean, fabulous, and perhaps more importantly, loved and not dead.
Is that a dig at Freddie for being dead?
No, Jesus! Don't say that! Of course it's not!
Okay, just checking.
So how does it feel to be a star?
It's never gonna last.
Let's just enjoy it while we can.
First sleeping arrangements, kiddo. All of this is gone.
I just hope you realise you're choosing a life of being alone forever.
Don't you want to just sing without this ridiculous paraphernalia?
People don't pay to see Reg White. They pay to see Elton John.
Sorry.
I know.
Care how much pressure I'm under.
Not really. I'll still be collecting my 20% long after you've killed yourself.
Maybe I should have tried to be more ordinary.
You were never ordinary.
So, I would like to start off by saying this is my first watch of this film because I hate musicals. So I didn't want to watch this at all because I knew it was like a jukebox musical and it would do the sort of the breaking of the fourth wall and breaking of the form that musicals do. And I just don't like musicals. So I was like, this is not one for me. Although I do like the songs of Elton John. However, I've since watched it and I don't feel like that anymore, which is good. So how do you two feel about this? Is this your first watch or do you love a musical or what?
I watched it when I meant to see it in the cinema, never got round to it. And so I watched it when it came on Sky and then watched it again for this episode. And I would say my love of Queen and my love of Elton John is about neck and neck.
Okay.
You know, I love them both dearly and their music. So this was, yeah.
Yeah. I saw this film at a screening because, and this is great because it's complete parity between the movies in terms of personal connections. I hosted the premiere for Rocket Man in Leicester Square. So I'd seen it in preparation for that. And as I said a moment ago, I went too early. But I came out of this a convert and a much bigger fan of Elton John than I was before I walked in. And I still listen to his music regularly now. So this had a transformative effect on me, this film. I mean, I did know some of his work. Like, you know how I like songs with really insanely catchy slash annoying moments? So Crocodile Rock was often on repeats because of la, 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 because that's just me. I like things like that. So, yeah, it's he's never going to be Queen for me because I came to him late. But yeah, I love this. I love the fact that this movie is a musical as well.
Whereas did you interview?
Rhapsody could have done with that.
Did you interview Elton at the premiere?
I did. Yes.
Did you not to him that maybe if we do this in the future on my podcast, could you come and be a guest? He would have been a great guest.
He should have done. Yeah, he would be so good. He really would.
He'd be excellent.
Yeah, no, he would. He would. I honestly, if you could see me right now, I'm like Paul Bettany in The Da Vinci Code. I got a belt around my leg and I'm tightening it. I've screwed up again. I'm self-flagellation this end.
All right, don't let it happen again.
So let's talk about how this film got made briefly, which does hark back to something I said on the Bohemian Rhapsody episode, because this was produced by Rocket Pictures, which, as you know, is Elton John and David Furnish's company. So straight away, you've got the man that it's about with some creative control. Although he said, Elton John says that it was David Furnish that was mostly on set, it's still... Is this just a personal thing? But for me, it removes that threat of misrepresentation. So it's a more comfortable view when you know that the man that it's about had something to say about how it was made. Having said that, it was in development for quite a long time, about 12 years before it got going. And Elton John said it needed to be R-rated, not to gloss over the drug addiction that he went through or his sexuality, and required, quote marks, a bit of strangeness to it, which I think it completely nails, which we'll come back to. At one point, I wish this had happened, it was going to be Tom Hardy playing Elton John, which, like, Taron Egerton is incredible, but, I mean, there's room in my life to see Tom Hardy in that orange demon suit, for sure. So it's a bit of a shame that didn't happen. But then eventually you've got Taron Egerton and Dexter Fletcher. And Paramount were the distributor because Elton John said no other studio would touch it with a barge pole, which is a nice vote of confidence. But in his own words, he hasn't led a PG-13 life. So it was possibly a bit more of a challenging sell. And then there would be naturally some questions about Taron Egerton, who's heterosexual, playing arguably the most famous gay man in the world. But we come back to my first point, which is it is a film about Elton John, and Elton John gave it the okay, as in you can play me. So that to me is kind of the last word on that. If the man that it's about says this is the kid, he stays in the picture, then that's it. And something that I think is important to point out, augmented my experience of it, is if you haven't seen it, that the songs are used to tell the emotional story of the film rather than the way in Bohemian Rhapsody it's like, this is how we made this song, this is how we made that song. So like a jukebox musical, which initially I was like, not my thing, but it definitely won me over. So that's kind of it, unless I've missed anything hugely entertaining.
I just thought one interesting aspect of it is that Elton John's diary is booked up for years and years in advance, basically, because of who he is. And so Dexter Fletcher was talking about the fact he was under an enormous amount of pressure while making this, because they knew that Elton John was going to be in Cannes in May, and he was told that's your deadline. And they didn't even know if the film would get accepted to the festival, but there was no way around it. They were only making that film if it was done in time for Cannes in May, which was, I think, a year away or less than a year. And so for a film like this with so many digital visual effects, all the choreography, the music, which was a very complicated, re-recording all the songs and then making the film to these new versions, I think it sounded like it was a stressful production.
Yeah,
but he did it because it got, I think it was not only accepted to Cannes, it got a huge standing ovation at the screening there. I think there's some footage. I think it's on YouTube or something where you can see Taron Egerton is welling up at the reaction, and everyone's on their feet, and it's they loved it at Cannes, this movie. And that's all. That's my the end. Sorry, I'll say end Cannes story.
Sorry, I just didn't know if there was anything else to say. Sorry, I am listening.
I love. Let me say this though. I like because. Dexter Fletcher, I think, is an absolutely fantastic director. He's a lovely bloke as well. I met him years and years ago when I had a walk-on part in the BBC show Hotel Babylon, and he was very nice.
Did you play a TV presenter called Alex Zane like you always do?
Listen, I have range, man. I have range. They just don't ask me. I'm not. They just keep wanting the same thing. They're like, we know that you're good at that. We got that. So he was lovely. And I've met him a few times since then at various bits and pieces. But like, even if I hadn't, like, you look at the movies he's made. Like, I really enjoyed his debut, Wild Bill. I think Sunshine on Leith, if you've seen that, it's a musical with the music of the Proclaimers.
Yeah.
It's honestly so good. It's such a really feel-good movie. I liked Eddie the Eagle. I thought that was great, if only for the scene where Hugh Jackman does a ski jump in a leather jacket with a cigarette in his mouth. I was like, sold on that. And I only found out when looking at stuff for this show, Sherlock Holmes 3, I didn't realize he was doing the new Sherlock Holmes in place of Guy Ritchie. Which is great. I think he'll be great at that. So yeah, I think he does it. I think he does it visually. This film is quite exceptional, especially some of the fantasy sequences, and especially like recreating things like Dodger Stadium. I think it looks cool.
Yes, it does. I think it's funny, Dexter Fletcher and Taron Egerton, when they're in interviews together about this film, it just there's a sense for me of overwhelming, like I'm really glad that this worked out, because it worked out brilliantly and you two really deserve it. I don't know why I feel so like warm towards them, but it's I don't know, it just seems like a nice story. Like, I don't think when this film was initially, you wouldn't necessarily have had Taron Egerton like earmarked to play him, but fucking hell, he does an amazing job. Amazing. And yeah, I just feel like he really deserves all the credit he's had for it. Anyway, so to get into the film, basically, Elton John, I mean, I really want to talk about his family. And again, come back to the point that he okayed this. So if it's okay with him, then it's okay with me. But fucking hell, his mum and dad are just so awful to him. Just so unloving and horrible. I know he's got a nice nana, thank fuck, who takes him to piano lessons, gives him a pound for the bus, which I thought was a bit harsh because she could just wait for him. But hey, it was the 70s or something, so maybe not. But just the dynamic between his parents, you could see why he may have issues with trust and love and whatever else, because his dad particularly is an asshole to him.
Yeah, but hilariously, I mean, as a character, I mean, I haven't fact checked any of this movie because, as I said, Bohemian Rhapsody took me the best part of 3 days to fact check. So I don't know what these people were really like. But like, as he's played in the film, like, he's just sort of know that the way he plays this inability to show affection, like he's sort of like, he's a bad father, but he's also this sort of uber geek as well. The way he sits there listening to his jazz, and then Elton John touches the record, he's like, "Never touch my records." It's so like, he's really good.
Yeah, he's brilliant, and it's interesting because you're waiting for certain lines. Like Chris said before, like some of it is very on the nose. And for his dad to say to him, "Don't look at that women's magazine, you're not a girl, and don't be so soft." And you're waiting for those lines because it's set up as a very typical sort of weirdly stilted British family that are incapable of expressing love. And you're just waiting for the dad to say to this quite sensitive boy, "Don't be so soft." But then when it happens, it's like it probably did happen like that, because people did used to talk to their kids like that.
But do you think the kid here says, "When are you going to hug me, Dad?" I'm not sure the kid said that.
No. I think he would have just cried and run off. It's such a shame. But anyway, Reginald, as he is then, he has got a gift. He's got an excellent ear for a tune. So he's like a piano prodigy, essentially. He can hear it, play it. And this gift will eventually take him to Denmark Street, where he'll meet lyricist Bernie Taupin, who is played by, I always do this, I always call him Billy Elliot because I'm a dick, Jamie Bell.
I'm never bringing you along to any interviews.
No, I know, what a dick. I know, sorry, Jamie Bell.
So I'm interviewing him. I'm interviewing Robert Downey Jr. I know you're a fan. Do you want to pop in? Oh, hello, Iron Man.
Awful, awful woman. Fuck off. Anyway,
who did you ask that time what their favourite soup was? I was thinking about that story the other day, and I couldn't for the life of me remember. Like a person you went.
It's Pinhead, Doug Bradley.
Yeah. Yeah, the poor guy was doing a Q&A and you went, hee, what's your favourite soup?
But that's the thing. That's excusable because I was a 16-year-old attention-seeking nightmare and now I'm a grown-up woman and I'm still doing it. Anyway, so he meets Jamie Bell. And they get on. And so Elton John, as he's then becoming, he needs a lyricist. He's great with a tune, but Bernie's got these incredible lyrics and they sort of bond over that. And they acquire a manager. I want to talk about Stephen Graham quickly.
Because he's brilliant in everything.
He steals it. He's in danger of stealing the whole thing. Like, it's a good job that Elton John kind of sacks him when he does, because if he was in any more of the film, I think he'd have to be on the poster. Like, he's fucking amazing. It's a tour de force.
He kind of plays the Mike Myers role from Bohemian Rhapsody, but in this, and better. And like,
oh my God.
He's not buried under so much prosthetics, he's really good. I do that scene with him. I think it's either with Stephen Graham or it might be with the other guy. There's a scene when he's in that office, at Taron Egerton, and they go, "What's your name?" And he goes, "Elton." And they go, "Elton what?" And then it does that really sort of zoom in on John Lennon's face in that picture of the Beatles on the wall. And he goes, "Elton John." And you're like, okay. For me, that could have been played for laughs a bit more. Like, he zoomed in on one poster first. He'd been like, "Elton Springsteen? No, wait. Elton Zeppelin. No, Elton John." Like a real stupid Usual Suspects moment.
Yeah. There's a line from Stephen Graham, which it feels like an ad-lib because it's done so well. And I would really love to know if it's in the script. Like, when it's going really well for Elton John and Stephen Graham's going to make a lot of money, he's very happy. And he just buttons the scene by saying, "I'm going to have a massage," end scene. And it's just so brilliantly done. Like, because he's like rubbing his little hands together, like, "I'm going to have a massage." And he doesn't mean a massage, if you know what I'm saying. But it was just so like snap. Oh, I was in love with it. Anyway. So we start to see Elton John and Bernie working together. There's something I had a little bit like. I don't feel like the opportunity was taken as much as it is in the other sections of the film. Like when they're talking about them writing Your Song. So there's the anecdote that Elton John wrote Your Song in the time it takes you to have a shave, like 5 minutes, basically. So they show Bernie literally having a shave, and then he's knocked out Your Song, but. To me, you want to do something more narrative with that moment rather than being like, "Oh, isn't he quick? Isn't he good at doing this quickly?" It's like, we kind of get it. Like, we know that he's quick and he's a genius. So maybe do something, because that Your Song is such a big song for people that it felt like a wasted opportunity.
I think that the way Elton John has talked about that scene, though, is that's how it happened, that he was sitting in that room at that piano and in 20 minutes he had it. And I think what they were trying to show was that, which a lot of biopics don't show, is that inspiration can hit at really mundane moments, you know, when you're just waiting for your tea. And he said, within 20 minutes, I just had this. And he said he knew the moment he'd finished it that he had something special and that he had taken them to the next level. And so I think this was the one time in this film where because I do quite hate in biopics, and they do it quite a lot in Bohemian Rhapsody, show you when inspiration hits someone. And those scenes always make me cringe. But I kind of bought into this one. And also, they didn't overplay. I think in Rhapsody, they keep repeating the, "Oh, and then this song inspiration hit here and here." And here, I think they just show it once. This is his process. You know, he gets given the lyrics and he writes the music and then bang, it's done.
Yeah. When it really gets going for me, when it came together, again, when I was fully like, this is a musical, which I now am in love with, was when we get to the Troubadour. So they tour America, and it's the point when they're doing Crocodile Rock, and Because the atmosphere in the venue is so electric and it's going really well, Elton like floats up in the air off the piano. And so to me, I was like, oh, I get this now. Like I'm excited about what they can do with the musical element, as in a musical, that isn't confined by a stage show, because it's film, you can do whatever you want. So you can have the showmanship, the dancing, you can cut it so that it matches your heartbeat, all of that thing, which is amazing. And for me, to feel like that about a musical, that's a big journey for me.
Michael Stipe said that scene where he's floating, he told Elton John that was the first time he'd seen that moment captured on screen, that feeling you get as an artist when you've got the audience in the palm of your hand. And Elton was saying, yeah, it only happens for maybe 4 or 5 seconds. You have that feeling where you're going to take off, and only, you know, in 1 in 5 gigs you get it. But he said, because Elton said that he really doesn't like playing Crocodile Rock, but he has to play it because people love it. And so he really...
Yeah, I love it!
From the sounds of it, he really didn't know how they were going to use his songs in this movie. I've got a few quotes from him about this, but he said that when it got to the Troubadour scene, when he watched it for the first time and he realised that was where they'd chosen to use Crocodile Rock, he was kind of upset. But then when he saw the way they used it, he got it. He thought it was they perfectly captured something that few people have experienced.
Yeah.
I looked at, because I was, the floating bit where his legs go behind him, I was interested in. And so I Googled Elton John, the Troubadour, and loads of images come up of him floating, like with his legs in the air, like actual photos from that gig. And because it just takes me a while to put certain things together, I start going, what? How? So what? Did he have... It seems unlikely that they were doing wire work at the Troubadour that night, and he was attached to some wires. And then I sort of realised that it's just stills of him slamming his hands down on the piano keys and kicking his legs back above his head. But he does do that. Like, it's a signature move of his, or it was. So that's the other part of the genesis of that moment.
Yeah, they show the photo at the end of the film in the credits, Al, as well. You didn't have to Google it.
Oh, I don't stick around for the credits, mate. Okay. Busy, busy, busy. I'm like, end, good. The minute that's, I'm like, great, thank you.
So everything's going brilliantly for Elton after that gig, and we're going to start to see like the initial sort of seeds of like discontent. So Bernie is a bit busy trying to shag some girl at Mama Cass's house. So here is sexy Richard Madden, aka John Reed, to cheer you up. But he's a baddie, and you should know that. So he,
I felt like in both films, when these impresarios show up, they should be twirling moustaches. Like, they're so obviously presented as the villains of the pieces, when in reality, again, I feel like they wouldn't have appeared like that to begin with, you know? They might have been in it for the money, but I'm sure they were a bit more, you know, a bit more fun in those first few scenes.
Interesting. Yeah. We'll put this under the headline "Overflow from Monday's episode." But you're not wrong, Chris, because Aidan Gillen obviously plays John Reed in Bohemian Rhapsody, and you see there's a scene where Freddie literally throws him out of the car and goes, "Get out! I'm done with you. You're not part of this anymore." And it's a really sort of like, "Oh man, Freddie hates this guy, and John Reed is a bad un." Truth. Didn't happen at all. They actually left on very amicable terms. John Reed like went, "I'm going to go concentrate on Elton John. This is Jim Beach, who'll be played by Tom Hollander in the film. He's going to come in, he's going to look after you from now." And it was they were friends. They were absolutely fine with it. It was all roses. So again, another. It's a late entry for lies in Bohemian Rhapsody.
But in Rocket Man, like the lines that Richard Madden gets once he's sort of balls out, "I'm a baddie," so he's been cheating on Elton and he's clearly in it for the money and doesn't love him. Oh, he hits him. Do you remember? Like, he slaps him across the face or he punches him or something. He makes him come out to his mum, and that goes horribly wrong, or it doesn't go well. But he says to Elton John, "You're stuck with me. I'll still be taking my 20% long after you've killed yourself." It's like, fucking hell. Like, as lines go of like, I'm bad and I don't give a shit. I thought it was an amazing line.
Yeah.
But it could also, you could twist it. I know he's meant to be a villain, but like that line isn't necessarily as callous as it initially sounds, because he could be giving Elton John a wake up call. Like, you know, he is basically going, look, you like, you think you're doing this and it's cool, or you're doing it because you're angry with me, but ultimately you die and things will keep on going. So maybe don't kill yourself to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I take that point. You could play it either way, I suppose. And then we're sort of in the section, bearing in mind this is being narrated from a support group where Elton John has walked in at the beginning dressed as an orange demon. He's like, I'm an alcoholic, I'm addicted to sex, shopping, I'm bulimic, like I'm a mess, but I'm here. And he's talking us through the events that led up to him walking into that meeting. So things are going out of control. And he tries to kill himself at a party of his. It's really sad. And then we get a brilliant bit, which is the song Rocket Man, which obviously we've been waiting for, but done musical style, but really downplayed. So we do have the moment where Taron Egerton as Elton John shoots off the stage like a rocket, but it's not for the song Rocket Man. He's on a stretcher. Do you remember, like a hospital stretcher? And it's just really good dance. Like, it's really beautifully done to show how disconnected he is from his life at that point.
And that really happened as well. That's the most amazing thing. He was on stage, like, I believe, and I didn't fact check myself, so I'm now becoming part of the problem. Mm. But I believe he was on stage the following night on Dodger Stadium after having that heart attack at a party. He overdosed, had a heart attack, and then the following night did do the Dodger Stadium gig, which is like, you know, I mean, in a really perverse way. Hey, well done, man. That must have been hard. Congratulations. Nailed it.
Elton recently did a live tweet of the film.
I know. I was watching it the same time they were doing that and I didn't know about it. I literally started watching it at 7 o'clock on Thursday, finished watching it, thought, oh, I might have a look at what Elton John's saying on Twitter, and went, that's it for the live tweet of Rocket Man. It's just finished. I was like, what? I could have been doing it with you.
Well, luckily I was paying attention. And I thought my favorite tweet was in reference to this part of his life. He said, it took a fairly Herculean effort to get yourself notice for taking too much cocaine in the music industry of 1970s LA, but I was clearly prepared to put in the hours.
That's brilliant.
I've got a really fun quote from Elton John about when he realized he was sort of like going too far and doing too much. And he was in a hotel and he rang, I think it was his manager or his management, whoever, and said, it's too windy here. Can you do something about that? And then just thinking, what? Like, you've just rung your manager to be like, the wind outside, can you fix that for me? Because it's not working for me right now. And then was like, maybe I need to sort myself out a little bit.
And yet, no matter how hard Elton John would go, he said that Freddie Mercury could always outparty him.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Would have been nice to see that in the other film.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He just says, how many holes does a straw have? 0, 1, or 2? The internet can't figure it out, so I've done what any sane person would do. Ask the Luke and the Pete.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Luke Moore for an unplanned half hour every Monday and Thursday as we talk about, well, anything really, from your emails to life's great mysteries to this guy.
The noise you're going to hear sounds like a man being interrupted by a car. He isn't being interrupted by the car. He is making the car sound.
Zina, that's a hippie.
Por quê?
How on earth is he doing that? Beep, 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 beep. How does he make that noise? Listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Beep, 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 beep.
The Luke and Pete Show is a Stakhanov production.
You mentioned that. I just wanted to. Did you like that conceit of everything being told from the AA or NA meeting, the support group that he was in? I really liked that, and I know it had to sort of as the film catches up with itself, but yeah. I was disappointed where that bit ended because I quite liked it as a wraparound. I might have liked to have seen him sort of sitting in it again as an older man and sort of still doing those meetings.
I agree with you. I think it didn't bother me as much as it should do, perhaps, that he is established as an unreliable narrator. Because it should bother me a bit more, because especially the stuff with his parents, like I've taken that quite hard. And if he's saying maybe it didn't quite happen like this because you know that I misremember things or misrepresent things slightly, then maybe that's a bit of a weirdness. But then equally, memory is such a weird, you know, your memory is completely unreliable. So it sort of makes sense.
I do think it would absolutely suck if you were one of the other people in that support group.
I thought that. Oh, no, it's like me. Like, we've all got problems, dude. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he comes in late and goes, oh, I'll be talking from here on in and for the rest of this meeting and at subsequent meetings as well. So shut up.
I've told you about that before because you come in late to a lot of stuff because it's a classic power move. If you come in late, you dominate the conversation because you change the conversation when you come in. You know this. That's why you do it. So I was cognizant of that. I was like, Elsa, that's really selfish. Like, so-and-so across the room wants to tell you about the time she fucking woke up in the bottom of a bin or whatever with her boss's pants on, but she hasn't got time to because it's all about you and your drugs and your shopping and whatnot. Anyway.
Is that a story, V, or is that did you just make up?
I made it up. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Also, by the way, I got to leave early this week, so chop chop.
Wait a minute! Oh my god! That's right. Yeah, that's right. The mask has slipped. Reveal all your tricks. That is your second most common trick. You've been doing that for such a long time. See how angry I am. Oh, classic you. Classic you. Yeah.
The only good thing about you leaving places early is it gives chance for Vicky to tell me about your psychology and what's really going on. So this is why he showed up late and left early today. It's a power play.
It's a power play. We get a good 10 minutes out of that, don't we? Usually. So Elton John literally gives the child version of himself a hug and... as the film, like you said, catches up to himself, he checks in to rehab, reconnects with Bernie, and we're on that stretch of the narrative, like, he's going to be okay. Like, and he tells his parents in a sort of, not a hallucination, but a sort of vision, that he's not going to let them talk to him like that anymore. And then we've got the happy ending, which is that he's been sober for ages, he's happily with David Furnish, he's loved, he's got two beautiful children, he's doing some amazing work for HIV and AIDS organisations around the world. Happy ending, and why the fuck not?
They shot a different ending, actually. It was him.
All right.
The original ending.
Possible different ending.
The original ending that Dexter shot had him at a concert, and he walked out in the crowd. He was walking on the hands of all the audience. And Dexter said it was much more elaborate and expensive, but it felt really forced. And so they replaced it with this, which is, I guess it's a little bit more understated, but it's also them using the song I'm Still Standing is the center point of that.
Oh, yeah. In doing the video at the end, that's so brilliant.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun because that's the first time you've seen him put into a video and actually superimposed him in Elton John footage, which is kind of the first time I realised, oh, hold on, we haven't actually, because there's a duet he has with, Taron has with Elton John that plays over the end credits called I'm Gonna Love Me Again. And that was when I realised, and it was only the second time, that we haven't actually heard Elton John through the whole film. There's not a moment where they play an Elton John singing. And I listened to the music producer talking about this. He said it was basically cheaper for them to re-record all the songs using Taron. But then they did have, like, when records were playing in the background of Elton John, they were going to use Elton John. And then they decided it would be wrong and unfair on Taron singing to have hear Elton singing next to Taron singing, because it would kind of call out the fact that it's not as good. But it's obviously happening, but I hadn't really clocked the fact that it's this Elton John musical where we don't hear him sing.
Yeah.
That song went on to win an Oscar as well, didn't it? Didn't it get Best Song, the Taron Egerton, Elton John
song? Might have
done.
There's not
movie?
Much competition, is there, for those blooming songs, though, is there, at the Oscars? I never think.
No, that's true.
One thing I do want to sort of talk about with this film is the fact that I think it's a really nicely crafted love story. But it's just a platonic love story between two men. They get the meet cute. They get the exciting stuff. They get the meet cute in the cafe, the Regency Cafe. I used to live across the road from that place. They're always shooting films in there. They have the exciting time. They have the breakup. They sort of work their way to getting. They have arguments in public, and then they end up getting back together at the end. And I just thought it was a lovely angle to take on this film. To be about this love story between two guys.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's well done.
I've never come across this before, someone who is just a lyricist. I mean, I know they, I obviously, it's a job, but it's kind of good that Elton John's songs are quite so lyrically brilliant, because otherwise you'd be going, well, he doesn't do much, does he? It's all Elton. He does the music and everything. But like the idea that Elton John doesn't write his own lyrics and Bernie Taupin does,
it's a really strange thing. It's really unique, the relationship they have. And Elton said that he's never, ever discussed with Bernie what the lyrics will be. Bernie has never, ever said to him, you've put the wrong music to these lyrics. This wasn't what I was going for. This wasn't the feeling I was going for. And yet, because people would say, when I'm Still Standing came out, they would say, oh, you must have spoken to Bernie about doing a song like this about that time in your life. And he said, no, he just knows me so well. And there's only two times that it's gone the other direction in terms of Elton writing the music first. And that was Don't Go Breaking My Heart. That was a tune he came up with and then asked Bernie to come up with lyrics for it. And he said he wanted it to be a duet with Kiki D. And then the other one was he had a line going around his head he couldn't shake off, which was, what have I got to do to make you love me? And so he spoke to Bernie and said, I've got this line. Can you turn it into a song? Which he turned into Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word. But aside from that, Elton said he's never written a lyric and never wanted to write a lyric. And then he said, the most exciting part of my process is the day the post arrives with Bernie's lyrics in them. And I've got to read through them, and then I've got to decide how the music should be. So it really is unique, but it's worked.
Yeah, I think it would be nice if we knew. I know there isn't really time for it, and it's a minor gripe, but Bernie is so forgiving. Like he does leave him when Elton John gets a bit much and is like shouting at him in the restaurant and stuff, but he forgives him really quickly. And I don't see enough of his character to understand why he's okay to forgive him beyond that he loves this man, and that's fine. But then I don't know why he loves him as much as he does, maybe, because there isn't much said about who he is as a person and what he's been up to in all this time, apart from how it connects with Elton John. No, it's his story, so that's okay. But when in rehab, he's like, he basically says, I'm sorry. And Bernie's like, yeah, don't worry about it. And you'd think, oh, I don't know. But it's
the weird thing is, it's true, though. They both said that while Elton sort of sent him away and said he didn't want to work with him for a while, they both say that they've never, ever had an argument or a falling out.
Yeah.
Bernie went away when Elton dumped him, and he wrote These Dreams for Heart, and he also wrote We Built This City for Starship.
Shut up!
So those
oh
could
my
have been,
God,
those...
I love that song!
I knew you would love it. And those could have been
I
Elton
do.
John songs. Elton John missed out
oh
on that.
Oh my God. God, this man is gifted. What's going on? It's such an do you think it's quite an exposing thing to do, to give someone essentially a poem and say, you want to put that to a tune? Like, I think it's quite, yeah, I don't know. It's very, very vulnerable.
I'm not saying you know the answer to this, but when you say he wrote We Built This City, did he just write the lyrics or did he write that song musically as well? Because that's interesting to me. He's a musician who just took a back seat. I mean, yeah. I know, I think he is a musician, but like, did he write the whole song or did he just sort of say to Starship,
I come
hey,
with
look
this
at that
trivia.
City.
I come with this trivia, this information, and then you call me up and I just don't know. You called me out, Alex. I don't know.
It's because it's Tilly Trivia is meant to be an unlimited resource, and I'm dipping into that pool and I want more. One thing that you can't really, obviously, like, you know, he's an alcoholic in the film. And so, you know, when I say this next bit, I'm going, that's bad. But like in another film, imagine this scene that I'm about to describe was in another film where the hero is cool and this is just the kind of shit they do. I do quite like the bit where he sits down to breakfast and pours half a bottle of vodka in a glass and then tops it up with orange juice and just starts drinking it in front of her as she's eating her eggs.
It's sad.
Yeah, of course it's sad. But you know what I mean? Just that sort of, if it was played for laughs, if it wasn't set within the construct of this movie,
I'm not judging, obviously. That's me at an all-inclusive resort holiday, obviously. So it's absolutely...
it's all of us, Vicky. Let's be honest, it's all of us.
So do you want to move to the bits or do you want to... Have you got any
I'm
more
done,
for any
yeah.
more?
I've done. I guess the only other bit of info I've got on it is it does really sound like Elton did let them just get on with the film, and he said that the first time he watched it was in a screening room, and it was the scene his family singing "I Want Love," which again is a bit on the nose, but he said that made him burst into tears, and then he was crying for the rest of the film. But it was interesting that a song that Bernie Taupin wrote those lyrics for Elton in 2001. And yet he said it was very strange seeing how it could capture really how I was feeling in the 1950s and how my family felt, even though it wasn't written for that. So, it's just really interesting the way they've taken films from different periods, moved them around in time, and they've managed to make a connection with those periods.
Yeah.
It must be quite a unique experience as well to have a film being made about your life that you take a step back from to the point that you do not know what the film is going to look like, what bits they've used or anything like that. And then to sit down and watch your life play out in front of you, not knowing what bits are going to pop up next. I imagine it's quite a, you know, quite an emotional experience.
Yeah, I bet it is. And it doesn't happen to that many people either.
No, I mean, I think the best I can hope for is you two doing a short play in the corner of a pub. So I've got that to look forward to.
What, when you're dead? Short play about your life. All right, whatever.
What a weird thing to want.
I mean, it's been playing on my mind a lot. So just
if you want to just script it and then just hand it out to us, maybe offer a bit of direction.
I am the opposite of Elton John. I'm going to be very hands-on about this.
we'll get right, Brian Singer to direct it. Yeah, go for it.
Your best scene, Chris?
I'm going to go with what you didn't like, Vicky, which was his family watching him compose Your Song. It sort of sent it's made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I think... it's a really special song, so I'm picking that scene, and that's also my favourite Elton John song because I know you're going to ask that as well. So,
I'd forgotten. Great, thank you so much, Alex. What's your best scene and favourite Elton John song?
Oh, thanks, Victoria. I can confirm from this end, my favourite song ties very neatly into my favourite scene in the film. I'm all about efficiency this week. So Crocodile Rock is my favourite song, and my favourite scene is la, 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 la. Love it so much. Do you know the song I mean?
Yeah.
The 8-year-old's favourite.
Yeah, it goes la 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 that one, la 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 la.
The only nursery rhyme in this film.
it's such a good song. It's got so much power. That chorus where it goes la 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 la. Anyway, that's my favourite song, and the Troubadour scene's my favourite scene. Smash.
My favourite scene is when Elton John goes to see his dad, and his dad has got new children, and Stephen McIntosh, as his evil cold dad, gets him to sign a record, and it breaks my heart. And he's like, oh, my dad finally cares about me and what I do. And he's like, no, it's for a mate at work. And I was just like, honestly, it broke my heart into pieces. I think it's very powerful. I mean, it's very black and white, like your dad is bad, but it's well done and well acted and blah, 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 blah. And it's just really stuck with me. Like when he's driving away and Stephen McIntosh, the dad that wouldn't give a hug, picks up his other two kids. He's like, come here, sweetheart. Oh, you haven't got your shoes on. Oh, I'm loving you loads and touching you loads. And poor Elton John is like, dad, you bastard. Like amazing, amazing writing. Do you want to know my favourite song, though, is Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I've been singing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road so much this week that I think I'm having a breakdown. Like, I can't stop singing it. I'm never not singing it. I got woken up by the children at 4:30 the other night, and I couldn't go back to sleep for an hour because I was singing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I love that song.
Are you having a breakdown?
Lockdown has sort of makes you feel like you're trapped in Kansas away from Oz, and Oz is representative of your freedom to go anywhere and do anything.
I'd like to think it isn't. I'd like to think it's because of the complicated key changes, but probably you're right, and I just really want to go out. So, yeah. Moving on. MVW, Alex.
Oh, great. Thanks for this. My MVW is Richard Madden's hair. it's so fucking awful. His hair is the worst. I hate it. It's terrifying, and it makes him the perfect villain for this film because it's so perfect. And the bit like where they're bonking in the cupboard, and you're like, I bet not a single hair is out of place.
Great.
His hair. I find it a villain in its own right in this film. There's the antagonist of Richard Madden as John Reed, and the antagonist of John Reed's hair as played by Richard Madden's hair / wig.
It's definitely a wig.
Is it, Victoria? Yes.
Chris, MVW.
Talking about that sex scene, Alex, you reminded me to say that the big news
I
around
mean,
this...
I wasn't, but just go right ahead.
I thought you said when they were having sex in a cupboard. Was that wrong?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I was. I thought you meant the one that they cut in, was it Russia? I think the big one where they're all like limbs on the bed.
Well, I'm just saying that this was kind of sold as the first gay sex scene in a major studio movie. That was the big news at the time. And I Googled that and there were loads of articles and I thought that can't be true. But then when I was sort of researching it, there's been a lot, but Brokeback Mountain, Black Swan, Carol, Call Me By Your Name, Moonlight were a few that I thought of, but they were all from independents or offshoots from major studios or subsidiaries. So it really was the first gay sex scene in a major studio movie, which is a big deal.
Yeah. What? Wow. I did not know that.
It's a big deal. And the fact it was hugely successful off the back of that, which is really something. But yeah, I could have said...
What was? Gay sex?
The film.
Oh, so, I thought it had a resurgence in popularity or something. Like you were like, yeah, it's.
Oh, that's how you do it. Oh, fine. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can do that.
It's never
like
gone away.
I'd like to try that.
It's never gone away, Alex. As I spent the 80s pretty much only listening to Queen or Elton John, I could have said the songs, but as I did for Bohemian Rhapsody, but I'm going to go with Dexter Fletcher. I think he was put in a really awkward position on Bohemian Rhapsody. And so it's nice to see him spread his rings here and get the credit he deserves. As you said earlier, I don't think he's made a bad film. I would urge people to seek out Wild Bill and Sunshine on Leith, as you said. I think they're both brilliant movies. And yeah, it's just a fantastic combination of sound and image and colour and dance. I think he completely nailed it. So Dexter Fletcher.
I want to say Stephen Graham, but that's just to be... That's not fair on Taron Egerton. When he walks into AA or NA or whatever the support group is, and I thought we were going to sort of cut away from that scene quite quickly and just get into some music or some dancing or whatever. And he sits down and he confesses his problems. And I was like, oh, he's going to have to cry because that's what's going to happen. And I was a bit nervous. Like, I just wondered if we were too soon into the film to see an actor having like quite a big moment to be crying and saying sorry for all this stuff. And he did it flawlessly. And from that, and then when you think about the singing and the sort of the physical changes he goes through and sort of shouldering the weight and the burden of the addiction and coming out the other side of it, he did a very good job. So he is my MVW. And then if you could change anything, Alex, what would you change?
I don't honestly know what kind of film I'm looking for here, because I know Bohemian Rhapsody was totally sanitized, and then this was like Elton John saying, I didn't lead a PG-13 life, so this is like, you're going to see everything. I just don't feel that we do. I feel like this is still, for all it, like, if you didn't have Bohemian Rhapsody as a comparison, then people could go, well, remember Bohemian Rhapsody? This is the real thing. And compared to Bohemian Rhapsody, it is. And yet it's still kid gloves. It's like, it's not a warts and all, like, telling of his story. It's still, like, it still pulls its punches. Now, whether... Like, what I'm saying I want to see is actually the kind of film that is would eventually be seen by no one. Like, no one would want to see it because it would be too much. And, you know, like, Elton John's songs might sit uncomfortably with scenes of hard drug use. But yeah, I still feel like I feel like there's maybe something a little more real to be told as a biopic of both Freddie Mercury and Elton John.
Yeah, I agree. What about you, Chris?
I want to see a porch. I want to see a tummy. I want to see tubby Elton John. Taron Egerton's got a pretty good body, and he's got a good body in this film. And I don't think Elton John had a pretty good body back then. So let's let it all hang out, you know?
Okay. Fine. Mine's pretty simple. I was really looking forward to seeing a really big musical number for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, because I love that song so much.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I really like it. And there isn't. Jamie Bell just looks a bit sad in a taxi, and then that's it. And that's not good enough for me. I wanted my Rocket Man moment, shooting off, whatever. I wanted him to be going down the yellow brick road, and it didn't happen. So it's a shame, personally, for me. But it's very personal. I appreciate that.
Just a quick one. That Rocket Man moment when he turns into a rocket. I do love when he ends up on a plane. It just cuts and he's sitting on a plane.
Yes!
And he's in different... I love the fact that scenes just start and he sort of like comes round in completely different clothes. I think that's a really, really great... good work, Dexter Fletcher. A really good way of creating like this idea that he's on so many drugs that he's just sort of coming round and he doesn't know where he is or how he got into these clothes, or he can't remember at least. And suddenly he's there and it's another part of his life, and he's just lost however long, days, 2 days or whatever. So I think that's a really nice way of doing it.
Agreed.
Right, that's the bits then, isn't it? Victoria, Christopher, me, let's do the verdict.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, two films went up against each other this week, Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man. Shall we turn to... who first? I'll go first. I'll get mine out if that's all right, unless anyone has a problem. Only because it's really difficult for me this week. Just to say it in black and white, Rocket Man is clearly the better film, full stop. Queen's music means so much more to me than Elton John's, full stop. So I'm very much torn between giving it to like the band that I love and a story that I'm much more interested in, or Rocket Man. And I think, you know, then I'd be giving it to Bohemian Rhapsody isn't really the story, though. It's like it's so far removed from the actual story. Am I giving it to something that is just like, you know, a collection of what ifs? To cut a long story short, I'm separating out Queen the band from this as a band that I love and giving it to a film, seeing as we are a film podcast and we are putting two films up against each other. So it's Rocket Man. Done.
This is not the fault of either film, but my viewing pleasure was hindered by the knowledge that Freddie Mercury has not been around to influence the script. And so I was taking everything I was seeing, it was making me nervous about whether or not that was okay and he would be all right about it. And because that's not the case with Rocket Man, I could just sit back and enjoy it. And I did like a 180. I don't like musicals and I really enjoyed it. So it's emphatically Rocket Man.
So Rocket Man is the winner, but the man who picked the films has yet to cast his vote. Is it going to be a full house for Rocket Man, Christopher Tilley?
Yes. as I said, I'm willing to bet not a single moment of being Rhapsody plays out like it did in real life. And I think that's a bad thing in a biopic. I think it's more like a two-hour montage cribbed from Freddie Mercury's Wikipedia page. That's what it feels like. I think Rocket Man's more visually inventive. I think it's really smart the way it uses the song. It feels honest and raw. There's no competition. Rocket Man is the better film.
Rocket Man is the winner of this week's Clash of the Titles. Do you agree? Do you disagree? At ClashPod on Twitter if you want to get verbose about this or indeed get verbose about our upcoming films. What are we doing next week? Victoria, it's your turn to pick.
All right, I'm going to say this really quickly because I think you're going to shout. Are you ready? Alex, Jaws, Chris, Jurassic Park. Have that.
Yeah. Hey.
Teeth. Teeth.
Teeth.
Oh. Okay. That is a great double, Vicky. I'm saying it now.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. Thanks. Strong.
Thanks.
Thank you for giving me Jaws as well. It is a great film, and I literally have just received the 4K Ultra HD disc, which I pre-ordered on Amazon. So I'm looking forward to giving that a spin on a Blu-ray player
on your big telly.
Oh yeah,
on my big TV. Yeah, all right, brilliant. Wow, we've got a big clash coming next week: Jurassic Park versus Jaws. Ooh, exciting! I will be back with everyone. Will be back. I don't know what I was going to say then.
That's weird. What was that? Jesus, what a way to tell us. That's so cool. We can't even see you. Oh Vicky, yeah. God. P.S. You're fired.
This is like when Freddie Mercury went solo. He's kicking he's kicking us out of the limo, Vicky.
Yeah. Oh, you've just killed Clash of the Titles. Will all three of us be back pending negotiations next week to do Jaws and Jurassic Park? Thank you for listening. Get in touch on Twitter at ClashPod, show@clashpod.com on email. And if you have the time, please rate and review us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The three of us will be back in a week. Bye-bye. On Monday. Bye-bye. The three of us. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.